This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jessica Siegel spent 9 years teaching high school English to some of America's newest immigrants. She taught at Seward High School in Manhattan's Lower East Side. When the school was built in 1930, the students were primarily from the families of Jewish and Italian immigrants. Now the school's population is 45% Hispanic, 45% Asian, and 7% African American. About 40% of the students drop out, yet the majority of students who graduate go on to college, trade school, or the military. A year in the life of teacher Jessica Siegel is the subject of a new book by journalist Samuel Friedman. He left his job at the New York Times to write this book. The school year that he observed Siegel, 1987-88, turned out to be her last as a teacher. She left teaching and running the school newspaper to become a freelance journalist and to direct a program designed to enrich the quality of high school journalism. Jessica Siegel and Samuel Friedman are my guests today. I asked Siegel if there's much violence in the neighborhood around Seward High and in the school itself.
Well, the Lower East Side is known by some as the drug marketplace of New York City. That was the place where the first Operation Pressure Point to try to get rid of crack started, and they tried the same operation in other boroughs. So crack is, and the violence that it brings with it is always there. Gangs are very active. The violence is there. It sometimes comes into the school, though rarely. I think, if anything, the school is kind of a haven for people. But it's always there. And the times that there is a fight, for example, and it didn't happen that often, it usually came from an incident that happened outside the school.
Well, you make the point in the book that a lot of the most violent high school age kids don't bother going to school, and that's one of the things that saves a school from being very violent.
Yeah, but I think it's important really to think about is that, yes, that's absolutely true, and I think Sam talks about, you know, these BMWs that drive around the school sort of flaunting the riches you can get if you get into the drug trade. But I think that another thing that comes out in the book is that so many kids are on the edge. I mean, when you think about the moral decisions that kids have to make every day when they walk by these people who are selling crack for which they can make $1,000 a week, in a sense, every day is a moral decision, and many people are on the edge.
Yeah, actually, these kids come out in some ways incredibly morally armored. Now, watching some of Jessica's students get into college, it's been interesting to see them rather shocked by the amount of beer drinking, for instance, that some of their classmates from suburban towns partake in. Because if you grow up outside the city, as I did, for instance, there's a forbidden fruit quality to drug use, to overdoing it with alcohol, all those things, because you don't really have a sense of how treacherous they are. The kids on the Lower East Side have had instruction from their youth in exactly what the consequence is. And I think that the kids who get involved don't do it because of any allure on the part of getting high. They do it because of the economic gravity sucking them in. And the kids who don't partake or who dabble and then are able to extricate themselves. And I mean, I remember a kid at Seward who had started using heroin at 13 and just was sensible enough to stop on his own. Those kids are so well defended in terms of their common sense by the time they're 17 or 18 that I really feel that in many ways they're almost impregnable, at least to that kind of problem later in life.
I think that one of the things you really have to do when you're teaching is to let the kids know that the classroom is a safe haven, and you have to be able to back that up, you know, so that they really do have confidence that the classroom is safe. Jessica, how would you establish that with the students, and how did you do it when you were inexperienced, and how did that change when you became a veteran?
A couple of things. I think I'm not sure how you're using the word safe. I'm interpreting it to mean safe that you can say anything, safe that you can try out ideas, safe you can...
And that you're physically safe, that no one's going to beat you up while you're in class. No one's going to pull a knife on you while you're in class.
Well, believe it or not, I mean...
I taught very briefly, and that was, I thought, a real big issue when I was teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never felt that way. I mean, all I can say is I'm 5'3½", and I walk down the halls, and I never felt physically threatened. So, I don't know what to say. I think as a new teacher, and Sam describes this very well, I mean, you know, the thing about getting your sea legs, about learning how to teach is a big issue. I mean, Yes, when I started teaching, I couldn't control a class. Yes, there were paper airplanes thrown and crumpled up pieces of paper. Yes, people were screaming, you know, and saying, he pulled my hair, that kind of stuff, despite the fact that it was in high school. All those things happened. And, you know, that's no place that anybody wants to be in a class, because most of the people, whether they're not, they're the most studious people, or in fact have to be wooed into doing the assignment. Nobody wants to be trying to work in chaos where they can't even hear themselves think. So that part of it was a process where of trial and error, of bombing a lot, of picking up pointers from colleagues, of trying things and failing again, and learning a little bit more, and learning from my students what kinds of things worked and what didn't.
Jessica, you had students who were, some of whom were homeless, some of whom were living in shelters, many of whom were from, like, poor families. How important is it to really understand the home life of each of your students? And when you have 140 students, what can you do to get a sense of what their lives are like outside of school and how that's going to affect the kind of students that they are and how you can help them in their learning?
Well, I always thought it was important in my English classes to have my students write autobiographies, because I really feel that in the 40 minutes a day that you have kids sit in front of you, there's always more to know. I mean, if a kid falls asleep in class or doesn't do the homework for 2 weeks or is absent for a week, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's bored or you're boring. I mean, it didn't take me long working at Seward to figure out there's a whole lot of other things that affect how a student does. What I found, well, first of all, let me just add that I would say in the 10 years I taught, if 4 kids ever tried to get over by saying, feel sorry for me, I'm poor, it was a lot. Most kids are extraordinarily stoic, brave, and they assume that they have to deal with these things on their own. The autobiographies for me was a chance to get to know them better and a chance for them to tell me a little bit more about themselves. Some of the things I encountered in these autobiographies included a kid who wrote, and he is an incredible writer, about this incident that happened when he was 14. He was involved in gangs, and he was walking down the street with his best friend who wasn't involved in a gang, and they were attacked by another gang, and the friend was killed. And this kid ended up in the hospital. And when he woke up from his coma, he realized what had happened. He was so devastated by his friend being killed that he went to apologize to his friend's mother and visits the grave every year and really kind of turned his life around because of that. Another kid I discovered was a father, but unlike so many teenage males, took responsibility, married the young woman. They're together, they were both going to school, raising their daughter, and both working, and clearly showed a responsibility and maturity way beyond his years. Another young woman was living in such an abusive household that she chose to move out of her house and to live in a group home, which is, as you can imagine, not the greatest place to live, because she just couldn't take it anymore. Now, these are just, I mean, just 3 examples of the incredible things that these kids have to deal with, you know, parents who are institutionalized in mental institutions. It was really important for me to know about it and for them to tell me about it.
Now, you're the kind of teacher who really is behind the students. You want them to be able to succeed, to go to college, to get a scholarship. And at the same time, you have to grade them and you know if they haven't been doing well in class. Even if they would like to go to college, you have to give them that low grade, and that mm-hmm. low grade is going to keep them out
right.
of college. Was grading a terrible ethical crisis for you? Because you really wanted the kids to succeed, but there were times when you couldn't give them a good grade. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yes, it was. And I think, I mean, you know, those nights where I was deciding on grades, it was like I felt I was you know, Solomon or something. I really, you know, went through a lot of trials coming up with the grades. But, you know, obviously along the way I was saying, well, what happened to that revision of your autobiography? What happened to that revision of your, you know, your that essay you had to do? You know, and I was constantly harassing them. But the end, I had to give a grade and I had to you know, decide on based on the work they handed in.
So you felt you had to maintain certain standards no matter how much you really liked and admired a student.
Yeah, and a couple of times kids who failed my class came back the second time and really came through the second time because they realized what they had to do to pass the class. They realized that, you know, you couldn't get over the ones that were getting over and respected me for holding on to those standards.
So you think really the best kind of teacher for kids who are up against certain obstacles like poverty, like not having English as a first language, that the best thing to do is to really be a strong, assertive, tough teacher who has standards to maintain and isn't going to let people get away with things.
It's got to be a combination of both the traits Jessica manifested. It's got to be, on one hand, caring.
Right,
and then
exactly.
On the other hand,
I guess
standards,
I neglected to mention that.
Because you can't have one without the other. And that's
the problem
with people who think you can just come in and be prescriptive and say, read this, it's a great book. Do it because you need to get the mark to get into college. You need what Jessica had was the world of the 40 minutes in the class, which was read this because it's important and some good lessons on why something like Gatsby or Thoreau was important to a kid in 1987. But at the same time, there was the whole part she and a lot of other teachers play outside those 40 minutes, which is being guidance counselor, being social worker, being surrogate mother. And it's all that other work that makes a good 40 minutes in class possible.
Jessica, what were some of the things in the system, in the educational system, that you felt stood in your way or, you know, interfered with you doing your best?
Well, the one point that I feel extraordinarily strongly about is the idea of class size, which always comes down to money. But as far as I'm concerned, it's not a debatable point, especially since Bush is talking about being an education president. Because I had five classes a day of 34 students. Multiply that together, that's 170 kids a day. Now, I have to pat myself on the back to say that I was extraordinarily hardworking. I felt that writing was the chasm that separated kids from being able to move up in the world. In other words, a majority of my students, for example, to go to a job interview would know how to dress perfectly. And despite something that may surprise people, they also knew how not to talk in street language and to talk in formal English. But once they would be asked to write something, that's the chasm. So therefore, obviously, I put a lot of emphasis on writing and revision. And if you do that, and you have 170 students a day, that means you're constantly marking papers. I mean, every test I gave had two essays. Now, I had kids who complained to high heaven because nobody else had ever given them this. You know, all their teachers gave multiple choice questions. But, you know, how are they going to be prepared for college if they never have to write an essay, if they never have to express themselves in writing rather than just checking off true and false or A, B, C, or D? So doing that means that every time I gave a test, it was 8 hours of correcting. So my feeling is, you know, for teachers who, you know, are trying to do something, the only way to improve education for both them and to give the kids more personal attention is to reduce class sizes. And possibly for new teachers, ones who are just getting their feet on the ground, give them a reduced load so that they can learn to teach, be mentored by more experienced teachers, and really observe a lot of teachers so they can pick up pointers. Otherwise, I mean, things are never going to get better.
Did you have the books you needed, the supplies that you needed?
Well, I was lucky because I had a great chairman in the English department, which means that to a certain extent I could order books that I wanted, to a certain extent. The big issue for me was the Xerox machine. Because I know some of your listeners will be surprised to hear that in the New York City schools, and perhaps it's changing now. I don't know if new technology has quite hit. But what I was using were Dittos, Rexos. I'm sure people have to hunt back to, in their mind, to antediluvian times to remember what that was. It's these purple things that get all over you. And so every night I was typing these Rexos and then running them off. Now, when you think about how corporations and the government just churn out Xerox copies of things, I mean, law firms, like, throw out truckloads of you know, Xerox Xerox legal papers to think that if I wanted to do a short story from one book, I couldn't, you know, that I got out from the library or from home. I couldn't do it. I had to type it up. I mean, it's outrageous because, you know, otherwise you're limited to what's in the book room.
Sam Friedman wrote in his book about you that there were nights that you'd go home and cry.
Mm-hmm.
What would you be crying about on those nights?
Exhaustion, probably. I mean, probably exhaustion about all the work that it faced me by the time I got home and how much longer I had to work that night before I could then go to bed and get up in the morning.
To work some more.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you just have to ask yourself if it's possible to be a good teacher and to stay at it for very long when you're dealing with, what did you say, 170 students a day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just such an enormous... I don't know how people could keep that many names straight, let alone really understand each of the students.
Well, believe it or not, the names part is not that...
It's easy. Okay.
It's not that difficult. I mean, and I want to underline the fact is that there's some wonderful teachers who are still teaching, you know, at Seward and in other places and are keeping at it.
Also, the other thing that happens is that the kids become the gasoline that the teachers' engines run on.
Mm-hmm.
And that... There was not only nights when Jessica would cry, there were sometimes in her free periods when she'd sneak off to the school auditorium and just sob. And, you know, being the journalistic sniper that I am, I'd sit a couple of rows behind making notes on what the sobs sounded like. But then she'd go back into class, and it was incredible to see the kids transform her, that they would nourish her. And that would let her stay 10 years teaching 170 kids a day in those conditions was her ability to feed off those young people. And what keeps, I think, a lot of her friends in school is the same thing. And I guess the other point about her leaving is that we have perhaps this exaggerated idea of the importance of longevity, and that it's great if someone can stay and teach 40 years and be committed at it. But there are a lot of people at Seward who had been there 30 years corporeally and had been there emotionally about 5 years. And what Jessica did in 10 years was have a whole lifetime career of success.
Jessica, you should explain why you did leave. Because we haven't really gotten to that yet.
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, I think any decision is a combination of personal and external factors. I mean, I think the workload that I was feeling, that I had no free time for myself, all I did was work, that. I think another aspect was I taught journalism, and in a sense, I felt kind of like it could have reactivated my feelings about journalism, because I felt like, you know, a marathon or a long distance runner who had sort of given up and then started teaching young people and then sort of reactivated their own love for it, and that's, that's the same thing for me in journalism.
Jessica, you mentioned you'd love to see the large class sizes cut down. I'd like both of you, from the perspective of teacher and journalist, to comment on other changes you'd like to see in the public schools.
All right. My wish list would be, especially in cities, no school more than 1,500 students, no class more than 20 or 22 students, a guidance counselor to student ratio instead of the current 600 to 1, more like 200 or 150 to 1, which is hardly great anyway, but is at least human. I think that there should be expansion of a couple of existing programs for teachers. There's one in Rochester, New York, that identifies master teachers, pays them $70,000 a year, which is a wage you can raise a family on in Rochester, and says in return for that title and that high pay, you will mentor a younger teacher, you will officially become a kind of surrogate parent to a dozen students, and you will work the year round rather than 10 months. That ought to be in place in every school district in the country. There's a program in the state of Connecticut where college kids who will commit a certain number of years, I'm not sure exactly how many, to teaching in the state schools, get a tuition tax break or a waiver of some sort. I think that should be in every single state in the union. New Jersey has brought in alternative certification. I think that's really important because you have to face the fact that perhaps you'll never get enough Jessica Siegels coming into teaching, even if you increase it. But there are a lot of Sam Friedmans out there who are people who are doing other things but like to teach and might come in to teach a course or two if you'd make it possible for them to get paid and not to have to go through this emasculating bureaucracy. For instance, you know, I've worked 10 years in newspapers, wrote a book. I'm qualified to teach graduate students in journalism at Columbia University. I just finished teaching a term up there. I'm not qualified to teach journalism for pay in the New York public school system because my undergraduate major happened to be history instead of English. You know, that kind of absurdity has got to be ended. So you need, in that case, to break down the hegemony that the union has on hiring in a lot of places, certainly in New York City. And those are just all common sense solutions. The tragedy, the thing that galls me to no end, is that educators and parents, and even tragically to some extent, teachers themselves are ready to embrace this trend or that trend, this buzz phrase or that buzz phrase, whether it's relevance in the 60s, back to basics in the 70s, or school-based management in the 80s heading into the 90s. And there's so little stock put in common sense, so little stock put in what any classroom teacher and any of their kids knows are the easy solutions. And they are easy if you, you know, put the resources there and to some extent shift existing resources out of these, you know, Xanadus of bureaucracy like the New York Board of Ed headquarters and down to the level of the schools. It's not hard. You know, Diane Ravitch, the educational historian, has been pounding the pulpit on exactly this point. It's just too bad the common sense, you know, counts for so little in our current education reform debate.
Jessica, what would you like to add to that list?
I cannot add a thing. I think that sounds great to me. I vote for Sam for president.
Teacher Jessica Siegel and journalist Samuel Friedman. Friedman's book, Small Victories, is about Siegel, her students and colleagues, and the urban high school where she taught. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.